evening, everyone, and welcome. It's a pleasure to welcome back Shoryu Bradley from Gyo Butsuji.
Right.
Good.
Good job.
Thank you.
Welcome. Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here back home in Austin, Texas. And I want to congratulate everyone for that beautiful ceremony that took place this weekend. It was an amazing thing to see all those people coming together to make this thing happen and how it went so smoothly. And my congratulations to your new Abbot Kosho and to all of you for the hard work and for having a new habit. So I think many of you have heard about the topic that I'm going to talk about tonight. And I sent this topic to Mako some weeks ago, and promptly after sending the email, thought, wait a minute, what am I doing? What was I thinking? This is a huge subject, and you know, it's going to be very difficult to even scratch the surface of it in 40 minutes or so, but I hope there's something meaningful that, you know, I can say to you. And I'll just give you a tiny perspective on this subject of what is enlightenment and can we attain it. So, first of all, what is enlightenment? Maybe a good source to go to is the Buddha himself. What did the Buddha experience in his awakening? And if we check the early Pali texts, you'll find different accounts, but there's no definitive account of exactly what it means, of what it meant to him. So we hear that he came to the knowledge of his past lives. He came to the knowledge of the past lives of other beings, all other beings. He came to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints or defilements. Came to the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, or he came to the knowledge of the 12 links of causation or dependent origination. So that's very interesting. But what I find interesting is something that the Buddha said right after his enlightenment. Just after his enlightenment, he said, "It's bitter to live neither paying respect nor giving obedience to anyone. What kind of samana, what kind of Brahman should I live under? Paying him respect and giving him obedience." So in ancient India especially, it was good to live paying homage to a senior. But the Buddha thought about it and he realized he had no senior because he had perfected his practice. And he had no one that he could honor as above him. So he thought about it a bit and he said, "I've been enlightened to this Dharma. What if I were to pay respect, give obedience, and live under this Dharma?" So this is the beginning, I think. And what was this Dharma that he awoke to? Basically, if we follow his teachings, if we go over his teachings, we find that he taught some very basic things, impermanence and non-self. Most all of his teachings can be summed up in that way. So especially in Zen, you know, we can say, and we do say, but I think others would say too, that there's really no difference between that teaching or that reality that he awoke to, or the words that he spoke to express that enlightenment, and the reality or truth itself that he awoke to. So he's paying homage to this reality that he expressed as impermanence and non-self. So I think this is like the origins of the Dharmakaya, you know, the Dharmakaya Buddha, the universal truth Buddha, that we pay homage to the teaching itself, or the truth that the teaching expresses. So this reality that he awoke to has been expressed a lot of different ways through different traditions and different times. We call it the middle way. We call it Prajnaparamita. We call it suchness. Shoho Jiso in the Lotus Sutra, the true reality of all beings. Or things as it is, as Suzuki Roshi said. Dogen Zenji called it Zenki, among other things. So here's a little hint of what enlightenment is, or what the reality is. Well, one thing I'd like to say before going on from there, one of the ways that I really like that this reality was expressed later is done through this allegory or metaphor of Indra's net. And in this net that stretches through all space and time, there's a knot at each intersection of the net. And in that knot is a jewel. And there's a jewel so all throughout the net. And every jewel reflects every other jewel. So if you look at one jewel, you see the entirety of the whole of time and space, or all of the other things in the net. But I think this is basically what Shakyamuni Buddha was teaching, impermanence and non-self, expressed in a kind of more colorful, elaborate way. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So the basic teachings that Shakyamuni taught were that it's craving or clinging that keeps us deluded. This is what delusion is. We can say it's clinging that keeps us from understanding or seeing this reality of Indra's net, or impermanence in non-self. So I'm going to get a little technical here, but I think this is a really good way to express an understanding of how this clinging happens, or what the problem is here, really. And that was expressed by the Yogacara school, or the consciousness-only school. They came up with a model for human consciousness that involved 8 layers of consciousness. So the first 6 layers are the sense organs and the normal thinking mind. But the really interesting layers of consciousness are below that. The deepest layer is called the Alaya consciousness, and it has all of the seeds of all of our past actions, experiences, all of our genetic makeup, everything we can think of that's us. And the consciousness just before it, called the Manas, grasps these things that the Alaya consciousness has and brings up an experience as self. So that's in a nutshell what it is. So this Manas affects all of the other consciousnesses, all of the sight, the things we hear, the smells, all of that is affected by this clinging to these seeds in this deep consciousness. So, of course, one way this was expressed is that it's an I-making. The Buddha himself talked about the I-making of the formations of the mind. So this is the I-making when we grasp these things that come up in our consciousness as me. You know, what we really think about things is the truth, and I'm the one thinking it. And I'm right and you're wrong is usually the way, it often goes. So that's the Manas consciousness. But why is it really a problem, this I-making? So one reason is that it blinds us to impermanence, and mainly the impermanence of ourselves, because if we think about time, now I'm going to talk about some kind of abstract things here, just so I hope you bear with me. If we think about time, we see that really our normal way of dealing with time as a reality of it flowing from the past into the present, into the future, is an illusion, because the past is already gone and the future hasn't come. So all we ever really have is now. We can only experience the past through our present consciousness. We can only experience or plan for the future through our present consciousness. But we need to feel within ourselves that there's something within us that isn't changing, so that we can experience the change of other things outside of us. In other words, we need this kind of linear time so we can do stuff, so we can set up a time to come for a talk and, you know, open the Zendo in the morning and tell people when to come. So we behave as if there really is some past, present, and future, but all there is this big now. But we cling to those seeds of linear time as I. And it's a big problem. Because basically, if we don't understand that we're impermanent, we don't even recognize our own suffering, for one thing, and we can't practice. So this is one of the big stumbling blocks that, ironically, you know, the passage of time and the way that we see other things changing makes us think that we're permanent. So that's one problem. The other thing has to do with space, and I'm going to get a little more spacey in talking about this. But I hope to present it maybe in a way that we hadn't talked about before to make it a little more interesting. Space is kind of the same thing, or distance. We need to sort of make a boundary around ourselves in order to do things and go places. You know, we need to pretend that there's some limitation to us. But when we really start experiencing our experience beyond clinging to concepts, our Zazen helps us with this. If we can settle down to the experience that we're really having, we see that this is also a fiction. So one way I like to talk about this is that, for example, you never leave here. You know, we say, I'm going to go over there, or I'm going to leave Arkansas, and I'm going to go to Austin next week, over there in Austin. But I travel the 600 miles to Austin, but I never get there. You know, there is never, we never say, there I am. It's always, here I am, or here we are. So this is kind of an amazing thing, because while I'm in Arkansas, the mountains, the birds, the turkeys, all of those things that are in my experience are actually creating my experience of me. And here, just as now, we're creating the experience of each other. We're all part of each other's selves. You know, you're having particular reaction to the words that I say, and I'm saying particular things because you're here. So we're really, you know, creating each other's experience. And this happens wherever we go. You know, we never get to a place where we're there and it's not us. So we're always here and now, wherever we go. So one way, I noticed that you had a picture of the Earth out there. I wonder if it's the same one or similar to this one. But think about this. Think about being an astronaut in 1972 on Apollo 17 and looking out of the cockpit, or looking out of the, whatever it is, the window of the capsule, and seeing that. There is Earth. You know, How many of us can say, there is Earth? But, of course, that's here. And actually being on the moon, you know, is here too. So if we could go out, travel out to somehow pass the Milky Way and look back at the Milky Way, you know, we would see the here of the Milky Way. In other words, wherever we go, if we were able to travel light years away to the ends of the universe, we would still be here and it would still be creating us, theoretically, I think. Some of us know these things better than others, the physicists among us, but I think that is Indra's net. You know, there's a little crossing in time and space that we call me, but actually it's always been this one big here and now. And the conscious mind can't grasp this. That's why this is such a hard thing to study, and why the Buddha, you know, kind of didn't want to teach at first, because it's very difficult to study. So one other little experiment, if you'll bear with me. Another small experiment, but on a very big topic. Of course, another thing that affects us deeply in the way we experience things and the way we're deluded about things is the karmic formations, the things in the Alaya consciousness that affect everything we experience. So we see things in a certain way that we just can't help it. So I'm going to do this. This is a human hand, right? It's very... very common thing. Most all of us have one. But see, I'm going to just do a few things with my hand and see if you can just catch the reaction that happens to you without thinking too much about it. But see if you can experience if there's anything that, any just sort of immediate thing that happens when I do certain things with my hand. So let's try that. See, we're laughing. It's kind of shocking, isn't it, though? I mean, did anybody feel... anybody feel anything uncomfortable there? I did, actually, feel kind of uncomfortable doing some of that. Never done anything like that before. In a Zendo. But that is karmic consciousness. You know, we can't help sort of giggling and laughing, or else saying, what the hell is he doing up there, you know, that sort of thing. Even though in some countries or some cultures, I don't think that would mean anything. Or some people who don't have the experience with these gestures wouldn't mean anything to them. Of course, we need this kind of thing. This human culture is based on this kind of thing. We have to have it. But we cling to it as real, though, that really means something, this hand gesture in itself. You know, we really think that that's some sort of truth underneath that, but it's just a hand, really. So that's our delusion in a nutshell. But what is enlightenment? What is our enlightenment? What did the very important Zen master Dogen Zenji, who founded the Soto school that this Sangha is a part of, what did he have to say about it? Well, first, before going into that, I'll say this is another huge topic, but, you know, classically there's this kind of difference of opinion between the sudden and the gradual approach to enlightenment. So one school of thought says, you have to work on things and you have to remove the defilements of the person and then do certain meditation practices and wisdom arises and eventually enlightenment occurs, sometimes over many eons, you know. Or there's the did I say that backwards? Did I just describe gradual? Okay, good. Sudden then. In one instant, you know, we can remove sort of the veil and become one with this reality and wisdom, you know, in one instant. is revealed in our consciousness and in our life. So, well, what does this mean for us? Awakening to this impermanence and non-self, you know, these two different approaches. So is it something that we have to cultivate and work at and have as a goal? Is it a process of self-improvement? Is it something that we have to sign up for and go through a certain program? Or is it something we can experience in one moment of insight? So, you read some things from what Dogen Zenji had to say about it, and there's kind of two perspectives that he actually had. So this is from the sudden kind of awakening perspective, or the absolute perspective, we can say. And there's a record of his interactions with his teacher in China called the Hokyoki. And this was when he was there training. And he was asking his teacher questions, and he said, well, the abbot, Nyojo, instructed, San Zen is dropping off body and mind. San Zen, it means Zazen here. Burning incense, prostrations, nimbutsu, repentance, and sutra recitation is not at all necessary. Just sit. So those are other Buddhist practices that were going on in Dogen Zenji's time. Then Dogen asked, what is dropping off body and mind? The abbot taught, dropping off body and mind is Zazen. When we just sit, we part from the five desires and become free from the five coverings. So he's saying in the moment of sitting that we go through all of those gradual practices. I think the five desires and the five coverings, you know, refer to gradual practice of cleansing the person from certain things that inhibit wisdom. Dogen Zenji also said, the way of the Buddhas and patriarchs is nothing but Zazen. Do not pursue anything else. He said, when we sit Zazen, what precept is not observed? What merit is not actualized? So here, like even dropping off body and mind, I think refers to the teaching of the Buddha, the five skandhas, everything that we experience is body or mind. So dropping off body and mind, I think, refers to enlightenment. The Buddha talked about enlightenment as being departing from the five skandhas. That was one way he talked about it. And Dogen Zenji is saying we do that immediately when we sit Zazen. We depart from the five skandhas, I think. And to him, Zazen is wisdom itself. We don't need to cultivate it in that way. Wisdom is manifest when we sit Zazen. But how can this be so? You know, how it's sounds very poetic and beautiful, but how can this really be so? All that eye clinging that we talked about earlier, you know, how can this really be so? But I think it really is. When we sit in Zazen, we just sit here naturally breathing. We don't make any effort to push down the Alaya consciousness at all. We let the seeds come up and we let them go. We let the thoughts, the emotions, everything come up. And we kind of put the manas, that middle consciousness or that consciousness above the Alaya, into neutral and just let it, you know, if we start clinging at who I am or what I'm thinking or what I want for lunch or whatever, we just let go and come back to the present here in this body and mind. So in that way, I think we really, enlightenment really is expressed in that moment. We really let go of the clinging to the self that is the problem here. And we can say, you know, the clinging, this is the clinging, I think the same clinging that the Buddha talked about in the 12-fold chain, the ninth link. It's a traditional way that, the process is interrupted, a rebirth, by letting go of that clinging. I think this is what Dogen Zenji was talking about, and that happens in Zazen. But actually, he takes it quite a bit further. He says, in another writing, when one displays the Buddha Mudra with one's whole body and mind sitting upright in this samadhi, even for a short time, everything in the entire Dharma world becomes Buddha Mudra. So the Buddha Mudra is Zazen. You know, that's the mudra, the whole body and mind, or the mudra. And all space in the universe completely becomes enlightenment. Simultaneously, all living beings of the Dharma world in the 10 directions and 6 realms become clear and pure in body and mind. They realize great emancipation and their own original face appears. So he says, not only do we experience supreme enlightenment in Zazen, but everything else in Indra's net, it resonates through all of Indra's net, I think is what he's saying here. Therefore, if only one person for a short time sits for a short time, because this Zazen is one with all existence and completely permeates all times, it performs everlasting Buddha guidance. So that's what he's saying. I think when we drop off our own delusion, we can't say that it doesn't affect the entire net. So there was an ancient Chinese master who talked about Indra's net and said that, you know, if you put a dot on one of the jewels, that you're putting a dot on every one of them. You know, think about that. They're all kind of mirrors for each other, and you put a dot on one place, and every one of them throughout the entire net, you see a dot on. And I think that's what Dogen Zenji is saying here, that our enlightenment permeates all space and time, because time and space are really one thing, here and now. Here and now, Indra's net. That sounds great, but then why do we still feel so bad? Why do we still get angry? Why do we are we greedy? Why do we still have problems and arguments? Well, I think Dogen Zenji actually had a relative perspective on this too. We don't hear about it so often, but basically, he said, this thing happens, but we have to keep doing it over and over again. It's possible to do this. Anytime, you know, when you're practicing and say anger comes up, and you practice with that anger, and somehow, you know, we release the anger, we release the self or whatever it might be, you're not conscious of this. But somehow that, you know, when that enlightened activity is expressed, that resonates through all time and space. But then the next moment it might come right back. So we have to keep practicing over and over again in every moment to express this enlightenment. But he did say, he did recognize actually that something happens when we do this to us. He said, to learn the practice and maintain the way is to abandon ego attachment and to follow the instructions of the teacher. The essence of this is being free from greed. To put an end to greed, first of all, you have to depart from egocentric self. In order to depart from egocentric self, seeing impermanence is the primary necessity. For a Zen monk, the primary attitude for self-improvement is the practice of shikantaza, or zazen, just sitting. Without considering whether you are clever or stupid, you will naturally improve if you practice zazen. The primary point you should attend to is detaching yourself from personal views. To detach yourself from personal views means not to cling to your body. the body and mind. So this is really important, I think, and something we don't talk about a lot in Soto Zen, but every time we sit Zazen, we're loosening up these connections between the Manas consciousness or the Alaya consciousness and the rest of our activity. You know, the teaching actually goes that, you know, the more you do something, the more you kind of create a habit pattern for it. And the more you break that habit pattern, the more likely you have the opportunity to express some kind of enlightened activity or some other kind of activity. So every time we do this, we open the hand of thought, as Uchamaroshi called it. We let go of our own particular universe of self-centeredness. Every time we do this, I think we're setting ourselves up for doing it again. And there's a lot of different ways that we can let go of this. There's a chapter of the Shobo Genzo called Attaining the Way Through Making Prostrations. And maybe I sort of had this in mind one time when I was dealing with a really hard judgment about somebody else and feeling really like I couldn't get over the pain that I thought this person had caused me. And it had been several years, and I decided, you know, I have to do something about this because the sort of resentment and pain was really festering up. And I ended up somehow, I got this idea somewhere of doing prostrations to a Buddha statue or a painting, I think, and then wishing this person well as I was doing that, like doing a kind of mantra. And it was amazing. Within a few weeks, it was totally changed for me. You know, the connection that somehow was really what I needed. You know, the connection to the resentment was somehow severed. And so this kind of thing can happen, I think. Often before I go into a sesshin, and many of you may have this experience, some of you might have this experience before you go into an intensive meditation retreat, is it, or maybe during the first day or something, you have some intense kind of suffering come up. Has this ever happened to you? And and then it's by the end, it's gone. And where did it go? And sometimes it's gone for good, you know. I mean, not always, but often our perspective can really change like this during the course of practice. The problem is if we go into sesshin saying, man, I'm going to get rid of that resentment this time. You know, you're just doing the activity of the manas there. So you can't let go of the clinging to the eye by doing the eye's agenda. That's the problem. That's why we say sit with no gaining idea. You know, sit just for the sake of sitting. You can't sit in order to let go of the self without just saying there's no reason to sit, kind of, you know, ironically. Otherwise we're setting up, you know, an agenda for the eye. So as a last comment on what this is that we call enlightenment, from a chapter of the Shobo Genzo called Arousing Bodhi Mind, Dogen Zenji says this: arousing Bodhi mind in the mind of the ultimate stage. So the ultimate stage is enlightenment, or maybe arhathood or Buddhahood, are not different. Between these two stages of the mind, the former is more difficult to arouse. It is the mind of faring across others before oneself. So he says that it's more difficult to arouse sincere Bodhi mind or awakening mind than it is to attain Buddhahood. Because he says that the true Bodhi mind or awakening mind is the mind that wants to ferry across others before oneself. And this ferrying across refers to, you know, the shore, the far shore of Nirvana. And there's a river. We're in samsara, and we cross over to the shore of Nirvana. This is the traditional early teaching. But the Dogen Zenji says, and the Bodhisattva vow says, we have to let others go first. So Dogen Zenji says that is awakening mind. In other words, practicing for others, doing things for others. The so-called ultimate stage refers to the awakening of the fruit of Buddhahood. When we compare Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, complete awakening, the awakening of the Buddha, with first arousing Bodhi mind, in a conventional sense, they're like the kalpani and the fire of a firefly. The kalpani is the conflagration at the end of a kalpa, or a world system. Big fire, the whole universe, everything up in flames. And he says, when we compare that, you know, to Buddhahood and awakening Bodhi mind on a conventional level, it's like that and a firefly. You know, how we can compare them. However, when we arouse the mind of ferrying across others before ourselves, these two are not at all different. So that is Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, complete awakening, when we start practicing outside of ourselves for others. So if we think about this, sort of the deepest way that we can let go of the burden of ourselves is to do something for someone else. You know, take the focus off of yourself and how can I help you? We think about the example of Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, what did he do after his enlightenment? He walked around all India for 45 years teaching people the way to awaken. A very difficult practice, and I'm sure he had a very difficult life on a certain level, but he was awake. He said he was enlightened. He was beyond suffering. So I'll just tell a story real quick about maybe illustrates this a little bit. There's a time when I was in Tassajara. I lived there for a few years, and as many of you know, there's a rhythm at Tassajara where there's a practice periods in the winter where there's intense Buddhist practice, and then for half the year there's still intense practice, but it's with other people that come in to stay there and share the practice with you and pay for lodgings. And so there's two different kinds of practice there. There's kind of work practice in the summer, and then more traditional, you know, ongo practice in the winter. And then between the two, there's a transition work period where you get ready for the people coming or going. And anyway, a lot of times the transition can be, sort of difficult if you've been there in silence for 6 months and then people start coming into work and it's a whole different culture, you know, a whole different thing going on. And especially if you haven't done it very much. But I think it was the first year I was there. Had really enjoyed the practice periods, but it was during work period, this period to prepare, and people were there, a lot of people there making noise and, you know, doing what they had to do to work. And one day when I was really tired, we were going to evening zazen, and one of the things that happens sometimes when all of this newness comes in is that you might lose your seat. You have an assigned seat there, I think you still do, and in the Zendo. And so if there's a lot of chaos and there's a confusion if it's your day off or not, or whether you're going to be there, your seat might be given away. And so at that time, it was really important for me to have my seat, because my cushion, I was going to experience a lot of pain if I didn't have the right cushion and I wasn't, you know, in my seat. So I was tired and grumpy, and I was thinking, oh man, I sure hope they didn't give away my seat this time like they did last time. And you can, there's windows at the top of the Zendo. You can actually look in there if you're tall enough and see what's going on. And there must have been 90 people in there this night. It was just a lot of people that came. And it was overwhelming to the Eno, or the person who takes care of the Zendo. And I looked over to my seat, and sure enough, there was somebody sitting in my seat. And I was, you know, grumbling, oh, I can't believe it, I gotta get my seat away, I'm gonna have bad, painful, crummy zazen now. All of these childish things coming up. And I got in there, and the Eno said to me, I guess I was probably one of the only people that was, she recognized amongst the sea of people there, and she said, can you help? Because people were just everywhere. They didn't know where to put them and were there enough cushions. Where do we get the cushions? And in that moment, everything changed. My whole world, you know, was, can I help? And before, my whole world was, this is crummy deal and that life is no good, you know. And it's their fault and, you know, I'm a victim kind of thing. In the next moment, it was, all of that was gone. Like, well, what can I do? There were 90 people there who wanted to sit zazen and practice the way, and I could help with that. So I think that's what Dogen Zenji was talking about here, and that doesn't mean it's an enlightenment experience. It's just what we need to do as human beings, you know, to get along in this world, and to make it a sane place to live in. I think that's the essence of what we do here in our practice and the essence of our zazen. And it does. You know, I think that I really had a hard time with these grandiose words at one point about all things turning to enlightenment. But I think the more we sit and the more we settle down and see the reality of impermanence and non-self, that the more we do see that this really is it when we sit. And it is an offering. Just sitting itself is enough on a certain level. You know, that is the offering. And from that place, we allow all of the rest of our activities of life to emanate from that. You know, from that sitting, where we make that the exact center, it's really important. And that's where the mind of ferrying others first, you know, comes from, is dropping off this manas clinging, you know, to me, and to my world, me as the center of the universe. Okay, I think I've talked long enough. Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.